from the radio station that brought you the Fall Drive thank you spot comes an on-air acknowledgement so controversial it will blow your mind.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's holiday membership drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
Oh, the humanity!
Our end-of-year fundraising campaign is still going on. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate right now.
Radio will never be the same again.
Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to kboo.fm/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Layli Long Soldier. Long Soldier holds a BFA in creative writing from the Institute of American Indian Arts and an MFA from Bard College. She has been a contributing editor at Drunken Boat, a poetry editor at Core Press, a faculty member at Dine College, and is currently teaching poetry at the Iowa Writers Workshop and the Randolph College Low Residency MFA. Layli Long Soldier's poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine, The New York Times, The American Poet, The American Reader, The Kenyon Review, and BOM, as well as in her chapbook, Cremosa Mori. She is the recipient of a Lannan Literary Award, a Native Arts and Cultures Foundation National Artist Fellowship, and a 2016 Whiting Award. Layli Long Soldier is here today to talk about her poetry collection Whereas from Grey Wolf Press. Whereas was a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry, shortlisted for the Griffin Poetry Prize, and winner of both the Penn Jean Stein Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award in Poetry. Natalie Diaz in the New York Times review of Whereas says, Long Soldier reminds readers of their physical and linguistic bodies as they are returned to language through their mouths and eyes and tongues across the fields of her poems. The New Yorker says that using elliptical prose, blank spaces, crossed out text, and Lakota words, Long Soldier articulates both her identity and her literary undertaking. Krista Tippett says, Layli Long Soldier's lyrical first book, Whereas, explores the freedom real apologies can bring and offers entry points for us all to histories that are not merely about the past. And the judges of the National Book Critics Circle Award say in their citation, Long Soldier's movement between collective and personal makes this book intimate and urgent. She has charted new ways to write in what's been left out, and not merely in the margins either. Whereas offers a powerful reckoning. Welcome to Between the Covers, Layli Long Soldier.
No, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So Whereas opens with a meditation on place, on language and relationship to place in a sequence of poems called Hey Sapa. And you also speak about the importance of place when you speak of your star quilt installation and your first class teaching at Iowa is a course on place. So I was hoping before you ground us in Whereas in relationship to place, perhaps you could first talk to us how you ground your students and orient them to place and language at Iowa. I'm presuming that your students are coming from all over the country, and you yourself are dislocated from the Southwest mm-hmm. and in Iowa. So tell us some of your thinking as you open a class in a new place yourself with these students.
Right. Well, that's a nice question. And in Iowa in particular, you're right, there's a great sense of, you know, when you're entering into any kind of academic environment, most often as a faculty member, as well as the student body, almost all of you are displaced in some way. You know, you're leaving home and you're coming to this new place. And so essentially you're there just for that program, right? Maybe that's your only anchor to that place. So that's kind of where we started with the course. I actually wanted to get the students grounded in where we were at. We are at in Iowa. So we kind of opened with some thoughts from Joy Harjo, who talks about, I can't remember the whole passage, but what was most interesting was she said, even placelessness is a place.
You know? I have the quote. I'll read it. The poet can not be separated from place.
That's right.
Even placelessness becomes a place. Mm-hmm. The world of conjecture, scholarship, and philosophical discourse is a place or series of places based on land and how one lives off the land.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
That was very fascinating.
Yes. So we started with that as something to think about. And then the first two classes in to start the semester off, we read Ray Youngbear, who is Meskwaki, and just about an hour up from Iowa City. So he lives close by. He's a local poet, native poet. And he actually, very last minute, came and visited our class, you know. So I felt like that was important. I wanted them to have an entryway into poetics and writing, thinking about someone who was from Iowa and not just first generation, but we're talking thousands of years, and there's a long history there of how his family, how his people acquired the land for their settlement. They don't have a reservation, it's actually a settlement, so there's all kinds of different mechanisms that go into that as well. So he shared some of that. He talked to us a bit about his philosophy of insignificance, which was very interesting. Just even that phrase has given me a lot to think about, you know.
Can you speak to that a little?
I'm going to be honest. We asked him directly to explain it, and he began just explaining. He explained it through story, which was very familiar in like talking to other native relatives or friends. That's the way of answering something. It's not just a one sentence answer.
Yeah.
So I cannot repeat to you a concise and definition of what he means by that exactly. But the best that I can summarize what I understood from him was really it was a connection, it was understanding kind of a connection to land. You know, and that you're just one, humans, people are just one part of this existence, you know, and a constant acknowledgement of your relatives around you, and those are the non-human relatives, you know, as well.
Can you speak to the group poem that you did in the class that maybe in light of this philosophy of connecting to the land?
Yeah, okay, so then we moved further into the semester, and we actually just did a little writing exercise one day, and I went online and I found several different sites that had, for example, a whole site on the various plant life indigenous plant life of Iowa. And so I printed this huge list, you know. I think there was a whole family of, I'm sorry, I can't remember all of the plants, but like these flowers and these grasses and all kinds of things. And then also the animals that were indigenous to the area, some of geology and so forth. And I just took those lists and I cut them up, and I gave each student a section to work with. And of course, there's poetry just in the names of things. It's so beautiful, you know. I asked them to just write two lines using one of the names on their list in each line. And then I said, I tricked you. You're only going to use one of those lines, so pick your favorite. Hmm. And then on the chalkboard, I had them come up and just each, when they were done, to come up and write that. And all together, it was this beautiful symphony, sort of honoring that place in some way as a group. And these just unexpected turns, twists and turns in the poem. So, yeah.
There was this really heartening interaction that I witnessed on Facebook with you talking about the painfulness of adjusting to Iowa from New Mexico, the amount of concrete and the humidity and the chill and the gray and both the lack of color environmentally and ethnically. Mm-hmm. And Joy Harjo reached out on your page to share that she, when she was there, struggled a lot too.
Yes.
And that she used to keep track of a calendar marking whenever the sun would show up.
Yes.
And that once it had gone over a month.
Yes.
And that her poem Grace is about this experience.
Yes.
And that poem begins with this incredible line: I think of wind and her wild ways, the year we had nothing to lose and lost it anyway in the cursed country of the fox. And then she goes on to describe her time there as, we lost a winter in stubborn memory, walked through cheap apartment walls, skated through fields of ghosts into a town that never wanted us. And finally, wind, I am still crazy. I know there is something larger than the memory of a dispossessed people. We have seen it. And it feels like this sort of brings me to, or brings us to, the first poem in Whereas, which also, I think, in the same spirit, is about place and memory and also the colonization and decolonization of language. So I was hoping maybe you could orient us to this poem and the language that you're interrogating in relationship to place.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, the book opens with Xesapa. And so if you know anything about Xesapa, that's the Black Hills in South Dakota. And so I opened the book with that piece because it is the place of origin for Lakota people. So our origin story is, as we understand it, that's where we come from. That's where we emerged from, out of the earth. And so I felt like that was how I wanted to begin the whole book, right? This place of origin. What else should I?
Well, what I'm interested in, I guess, is you go into how the language is misinterpreted when it is brought from Lakota to English.
Yes.
And then it is also again misinterpreted or retranslated back into Lakota using the error from the original translation, so that Lakota actually is changing.
Yes. So I've heard different versions of this, but this is what I heard when I was younger, is that Xesapa is like the original name for this place, for the Black Hills. So when settlers came and this, and we refer to this as the Black Chesapa, which actually translates, Che is mountain and Sapa is black. It was translated into English as Black Hills, and over time, a more contemporary way of referring to that place has been Pa Sapa, which is they've taken Black Hills and translated it back into Lakota so that it translates as Black Hill. Pa Sapa is the hill. Hmm. That is the version I heard when I was younger, and more recently, I can't remember, I don't remember where, I think it was on Facebook or something, someone was posting the reverse. They were saying Pa Sapa was the original, and I was giving that a little side eye. I don't know if that's the case, and this is the unfortunate thing, is that sometimes it's difficult to dig through history and, you know, just always find that definite place of truth, you know. So, but we have to allow for different versions, you know, so I accept that too. But this is what I understood. So Chesapa is what I refer to as the Black Hills, and this is what
could you read us the first page of Chesapa number one?
Sure. Chesapa. One. Che is a mountain, as he is a horn that comes from a shift in the river, throat to mouth. Followed by Sapa, a kind of black sleek in the rise of both. Remember, Chesapa is not a black hill, not Pa Sapa, by any name you call it. When it lives in the past tense, one would say it was not Redhorn either, was not a rider on horse, on mount, and did not lead a cavalry down the river and bend, not decoy to ambush and knee buckle, to 10 or 20, perhaps every, horse face in water. Its rank is a mountain, and must live as a mountain, as a black horn does, from base to black horn tip. See it as you come, you approach. To remember it, this is like gravel.
We've been listening to Layli Long Soldier read from Whereas. You mentioned that you begin the book because it's the origin place of the Lakota people, which makes it feel like an acknowledgement of place. And I guess I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on land acknowledgements, which I know have been happening in Australia and New Zealand and Canada longer than, but they seem to be catching on more in events in the United States. So that would be the, prior to this interview or before we continue this interview, to acknowledge that we're having it on the occupied lands of the Multnomah and Clackamas people, of the Chinook and Tualatin and Malala and many other tribes and bands that have lived in along the Columbia and Willamette River for thousands of years. But I also know that there's debate about them, and that Whereas is exploring this difference between words without actions and actions without words. So I just was curious if you see the tradition of land acknowledgments, which seem to be gaining steam, as an important first step towards possible change. Or do you see, or do you fear that the words stand in for change?
Well, that would be the danger, right? The danger is that it would become a stand-in. I actually feel like it's a nice step forward, because I think it brings it into the consciousness of people, you know, which I think wasn't in the consciousness at all, certainly when I was a young person and when I was in some of those spaces, there was no acknowledgement at all. So for me, I actually appreciate it. And it's a good reminder for me, even as a Native person, when I go to certain places, you know, there's over 560 federally recognized tribes. Even I am not completely up on every, you know, every tribe in every region. So when I, even myself, when I go to visit places and those people are acknowledged, it's good to hear and to hear their names, to hear the language and so on. So yeah, I actually appreciate it myself. Yeah,
I do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the middle section of this sequence of poems, mm-hmm. you sort of establish another theme or another line of questioning that runs through the collection. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get this poem that's written as a cube. And the perimeter of the cube are words, and the inside of the cube, most of the page is white space. Mm-hmm. And it feels like the poem is announcing itself as image before it announces itself as text. Mm-hmm. And it has this sort of Gertrude Stein-like iteration and reiteration of a phrase. And I was hoping maybe you could read it and then I could ask you a question about
sure.
it.
Yeah. This is how you see me, the space in which to place me. The space in me you see is this place. To see this space, see how you place me in you. This is how to place you in this space in which to see.
My favorite of those lines is the one that has the gap in it, the one that goes, this space in me you see is this place. And it feels like it in that one line, it sort of enacts a lot of what the collection is doing in a larger sense, not just pointing to the limitations of language, but also to things that exist outside of language. And one of the things it feels like you do with the breaking apart of language, either with these gaps or these crossed out words or prematurely interrupted sentences or words that have been split in half, or by your questioning of the act of writing itself in the writing, is that you're creating a space in language for unlanguageable things. Mm-hmm. And I to go back to, I apologize for mining your Facebook page, but on Facebook, you shared a night you had with your students in Iowa that made me think about this phenomenon in the book. And mm-hmm. at dinner, you're all discussing your reading habits as mm-hmm. as children, and they're talking about how they read, what they read, and what the difficulties were like of being literary geeks. And you said you remained largely quiet mm-hmm. because you didn't grow up reading books, but you grew up reading people. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to hear more about that, because mm-hmm. somehow I feel like it feels to me like there's some secret in that allows you to take the things outside of language and somehow create room for them in the language. And maybe I'm stretching there, but tell us about reading people growing up and how that has affected your writing practice, mm-hmm. if it has.
I think a lot of it is just my own nature. Of course, as an adult, I'm aster. I have to do a lot of things that require me to get outside of myself. You know, so For example, I teach, and so I cannot sit in the classroom in a corner and be an introvert. Mm-hmm. But I really honestly feel my natural state is really to be quiet and to be still. And I enjoy, and I always have as a child when I was growing up, enjoyed just, I can sit in a full room and be very happy. Be very content to just be completely quiet. and listen and to feel, kind of sense people's, I want to say energy, but I know that sounds so new agey, you know, but I don't know, they're to feel, mm-hmm. to sit in a place and to feel what's happening, you know, and I think just to listen, that really was just my natural kind of state, and I still enjoy being that way when I can be. Mm. And I think that's important to poetics too, you know. I mean, it's something I've thought about a lot, like being in Iowa. So I'm going to be very, I hope not too revealing here, but, you know, I'm in these classrooms with these incredible students who have been reading since they could walk, basically, you know, and they've read it all. And I literally sit there and take notes from them. Mm. I mean, the references and the, they'll say, oh, this reminds me of such and such poem by so-and-so. And I'll be quickly, you know, jotting it down and say, oh, I have to go look that up. And I'm learning from them. And I'm honest with them. I say, I feel like we are all here. We are all learning together, right? And then at the same time, I think, okay, what? And I'm still trying to, I feel like it's important to be able to articulate this, and I'm in the process of trying to, so I'll work it out with you a little bit here, but still somehow these beautiful students I'm working with now, somehow my path wasn't quite the same as some of them to getting to poetry and getting to these poems, you know. And I go home and I say, well, I did write these poems. There's a reason that they asked me to come and visit. So what's the difference here? Like, what is it about my own journey? And I really think it's not just reading people and listening, but it's also a thinking through, it can be a singular word, a single word, for example, that would just fascinate me. And this leads to a whole line of thinking. Like just last night at Lewis and Clark College, I had a reading and I read this piece, Opaque. Or it's not titled Opaque, but it's a section from a poem.
Yeah, that's actually, it's weird because that's what I have here to have you read next.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, you know, I was talking to the students last night about the fact that, you know, it's really a kind of, I think my journey has always been a kind, it's like through stumbling and fascination. So I can read Opaque maybe, and then I can talk a bit about, yeah.
That would be great.
That kind of, all right, here we go. Example. I have always wanted opaque to mean see-through, transparent. I'm disheartened to learn it means the opposite. Why this instinct to assign a definition based on sound? Opaque. I interpret O. Open, P, soft, A, airplane or directional flight, K, cut through, translating to that which is or allows air, airy, penetrating light, transparency, to say, you don't fool me for a second, you're opaque. To say I'm partial to opaque objects, I delight in luminosity. To say I'm interested in this painting on glass, brightly
opaque. I understand the need to define as a need for stability, that I and you can be things standing understood among each other. One word can be a poem, believe it. One word can destroy a poem, dare I say, I am writing to penetrate the opaque, but I confuse it too often. I negotiate instinct when a word of lightful meaning flips under, buries me in the work of blankets.
We've been listening to Layli Long Soldier read from Whereas. Did you want to say more about?
Well, no. Okay, so like this is a great example, and of course you weren't at the reading last night, so I'm not wanting to repeat myself. But since you weren't there, it's okay. But that is something that we talked about last night. Was this example of opaque and how I had gone through almost all of my, you know, most of my life thinking that this word meant transparent. And so, first of all, that's a kind of stumbling for me, or a moment of like, oh my goodness, how could this happen, you know, and a laughing at myself, you know. And then also, but it led to an examination of how is that. And so in the piece, I wanted to write about it, and I realized it really was the sound that communicated. And so I broke apart the sound, you know, O, P, A, K, right? What do those sounds communicate?
Mm-hmm.
And that was fascinating to me, you know, and there's something very, there's something in the very foundation of language, right? And how language is formed to communicate. It's the sound first,
yeah,
right? And so in any case, I think it's that kind of thing I'm always encouraging my students to. It's the poetics, it's, yes, there are aspects of form and line and craft, as they say, but also, you know, I'm always encouraging them to make lots of space for who you are in your way of thinking. It's not just thinking, it's your way of thinking through, right? Let people come with you, you know, on that path, right?
You've often brought up in interviews a line by Charles Olson that you don't relate to, actually, that says form is never more than an extension of content.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said that for you sometimes form comes first.
Mm-hmm.
A shape comes and there's no content until later that mm-hmm. the content is pulled into the form.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that for you, maybe an example of a poem or mm-hmm. a process mm-hmm. with regards to that. It sounds a little bit like you're doing that with the word opaque, because when you said the word O,
mm-hmm.
I saw the letter O
mm-hmm.
as not a letter, but as an image.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the piece that I just read, the cube, the square on the page, that's a great example, I think, of a time when form came to me first. So I was working on this piece, Chesapa, and I'd had the first, I knew I wanted it to be a longer piece. And I had the first two sections. And I had a sense of the direction. I knew that it was concerning land, this piece, obviously an origin. The second section is about the dragging, a a relative of ours actually that was found who was dragged to death. And this idea that, I mean, you know, we have this relative who was dragged in our family, and it was so long ago, but it's like, so you would think, okay, everyone moves on. But every few years that I always end up hearing, somebody will talk about it. You know, it surfaces again. And of course, the history that we have, you know, and Pine Ridge specifically, and then, you know, just in general, Native people with land, and this disposability of our people for the sake of land is something you just can't get past, right? So that was also something that was important to me in this piece. But anyway, one day I remember thinking about this poem, and I was halfway through it. And for whatever reason, I just knew and felt that there needed to be a square. There needed to be a square on a page. And I didn't know why. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even explain it to myself, except I felt it. There needs to be a blank page, and there needs to be a very simple square in the middle of it. And the words need to be, you know, at each side of the square, and that's all I had to go with. I didn't know why, so I remember sitting at my laptop having this image and just waiting for the words to come. And I think it's because shape also communicates, just like sound, just like opaque, you know. But shape says something before the reader, and maybe even before the writer comes to the page. This a shape is telling you. It's saying something. So it's almost like I had to wait for that square to tell me what it wanted to say, you know.
Yeah.
So I waited and I tapped out each little word, you know, patiently waiting word by word. I got the first line done, and then I realized, I said, I think each side of this square, the words need to remain the same. I need to use the same language for each side. So, and then that sort of became the structure, the constraints that I worked with, and then I finished that section. But I don't know if that answers your question.
It does, and I kind of want to ask it again anyways. Okay. but in a different way. Mm-hmm. Because you're also a visual artist. Mm-hmm. That uses text. Mm-hmm. And you did a project called Buffalo Book with 21 buffalo made out of metal mesh that had text in each of their bodies. Mm-hmm. And more recently, you've done a show called All My Relatives. Mm-hmm. Of a Lakota star quilt, where you used copper wire as thread and paper as the fabric that mm-hmm. was laser etched with words.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could both tell us the significance of star quilts, but then also your thinking process on how to employ words when you're doing a project that begins with form, in this case, the star quilt.
Yeah. I'll start with the star quilt exhibit, or the Midakuye Oyasin. So I'll start with that, just because that takes the longest to explain. but that's actually more recent work. I think Buffalo Book was quite some time ago. I can't remember. But I was in an exhibit with two other Lakota artists, Mary and Clementine Bordeaux. So the three of us were interested in exploring this phrase in Lakota language that is Midakuye Oyasin. And it roughly, or it translates to we are all related, or all my relatives, something like that. And part of the reason we wanted to sort of unfold that phrase or look a little deeper into it is it's a phrase that a lot of people who are not Lakota have adopted. They've adopted, they'll repeat it and say it, you know, in public spaces, or they'll, you know, they say it both in English and Lakota. And it's often used as a way to create familiarity with people. In other words, you know, hey, we're relatives, we're all related and so on. But I don't think that people always understand the sort of the greater context, that the Lakota view, the philosophy behind that. And so, in other words, if we are related, what does that mean, right? It's not just familiarity and, hey, all right, you know. There are then, to say you're related, to say you're a brother or sister or cousin or what have you, there are responsibilities then. You're entering into a relationship with someone, and that there's an exchange, right? And there's reciprocity. There's things that you do for each other as relatives. And also this idea that it's, as I mentioned earlier with Ray when I talked about Ray Youngbear, just this idea that relatives, being related, extends beyond just people, you know, and there's the world, being able to see the world around us, you know, and also above us, as something that we are in a relationship with, right? And having that regard, yeah.
And is the choice of using star quilts because the tradition is that you make a star quilt for somebody else?
Yes, so the star quilt is something that, you know, Lakota people or people in the Northern Plains area give to each other for, you know, special occasions and so on. So, yeah, so it's definitely often a gift of expressing that kind of relationship with one another. Yeah.
So when you start with that framework, similar to the way you start with a square, what were some of the considerations around what words you wanted to laser etch into the paper fabric?
Mm-hmm. That was a really, this has been a really special exhibit and undertaking for me. Those star quilts, I made one huge black one, and that was the most time consuming because it had the laser cutting and the copper wire and so on. And then I had a multicolored one, which I did not sew together. But all of that took about a year to make. But regarding the text, the language that I chose, so this was kind of a collaborative effort in some ways. So Mary was working sculpturally, and Clementine is a studied documentary film, so she was conducting interviews. So what she, and I think Mary also helped with the interviewing as well, but anyway, they interviewed six other Lakota women who were speakers in community, and also all of them were educators, which was interesting too. So they went out and interviewed, conducted interviews on this idea of Midakuye Oyasin, to share what they understood from that, the greater or deeper meanings of that. And so Clementine sent me audio clips to listen to. So I sat down and I listened to, you know, hours of that. Felt like hours, it was hours, and took notes, things that were, I think, important points that some of the women were making. Really interesting things. For example, one of the community members was talking about the making of dictionaries and some of the history of that, Lakota dictionaries, and a little bit of the politics and the involvement of the church in that and all of that. And those are things that I had heard from a few of my own family members. But it was nice to hear that, from outside my family as well, that this is an awareness that our community has as a whole. I heard someone else talk about grief, also anger, the importance of working through anger that we carry, given the history that we've lived through. Also intuition. Someone was talking this really beautiful thing about how it's our responsibility as Lakota people to develop our intuition. I'd never heard someone say it that way, that it is our responsibility to develop intuition, because this makes you a good relative.
Wow.
You know? So when someone is suffering, you know it. You can feel it, you know? And so on. If someone's in need, you can go to them. And, like, you know, so intuitively speaking, I mean, this intuition is a real, it was, listening to this interview, it was affirmed as a real, very real thing. And not just that, but that it's our duty, it's our obligation to strengthen it, you know. So there were all these beautiful things in these interviews, and I took notes. I also did some research of my own on certain ideas and things in our language, and that was how I developed those poems for the Star Quilt. And then the form, if you could see it on the page, actually I have some here with me, but I made it so that, how do I explain this on the radio? Okay. So the quilt has diamonds, okay. And the quilt is actually made out of heavy cotton paper from India. And so I laser cut phrases into each diamond. But the way it works is going from the top diamond, the top point, as you move downward, the reader can go in any direction downward and connect the phrases in any pattern that they would like. And hopefully, as they reach the bottom point, they've created a poem of their own. And hopefully the poem makes sense in some way, or a little bit of sense, you know, following, based on things from the interviews that I had.
One of the things that makes me think of in Whereas is your poem Diction, which you wrote in response to being a criticism you received in your MFA program.
Man, you've really researched.
But the reason why I think of it is because you were told that your personal I comes from a small world, right?
Yeah.
And that you needed to work on your diction. Mm-hmm. But then your response was the inviting of other people's voices into the poem in a way. Like, so in a way that, like the Star Quilt, you're sort of inviting the voices of others to create your diction. Could you speak a little bit about that poem and the voices that you invited into it?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, the first voice I guess I invited into that piece was Zintkala Shah, who was a Dakota writer. And she, I would say, in a lineage of, she's someone I would consider, I feel like, you know, she's a predecessor from the Northern Plains, Dakota heritage.
And she was a story writer, right?
Yes, she did write some poetry. She's more known for her fiction. So I used a paragraph from one of her stories about beadwork, but then I used, some erasure in that piece to kind of shape it into something that applies to writing. You know, this idea of design and finishing a thing once it's begun and so on. And then the next section, I worked with text from James Welch, who is also from up north. And
What I love about the experience of traveling through Whereas for the first time is that we get all of this experimentation and this interruption and the erasure and the white space. And then we arrive at the last poem in the first half. So it's in book is in two halves. And all of a sudden we have diction and syntax and punctuation that conforms to the norms, to the conventions of English. We're seeing a poem in complete sentences. And this poem is about the death sentence of the Dakota 38. So I was hoping maybe you would be willing to read the first page. And then we could talk a little bit about the circumstance that the end question raises.
Yeah, sure. Okay. 38. Here, the sentence will be respected. I will compose each sentence with care by minding what the rules of writing dictate. For example, all sentences will begin with capital letters. Likewise, the history of the sentence will be honored by ending each one with appropriate punctuation, such as a period or question mark, thus bringing the idea to momentary completion. You may like to know, I do not consider this a, quote, creative piece. I do not regard this as a poem of great imagination or a work of fiction. Also, historical events will not be dramatized for a, quote, interesting read. Therefore, I feel most responsible to the orderly sentence, conveyor of thought. That said, I will begin. You may or may not have heard about the Dakota 38. If this is the first time you've heard of it, you might wonder, what is the Dakota 38? The Dakota 38 refers to 38 Dakota men who were executed by hanging under orders from President Abraham Lincoln. To date, this is the largest, quote, legal mass execution in U.S. history. The hanging took place on December 26, 1862, the day after Christmas. This was the same week that President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. In the preceding sentence, I italicize same week for emphasis. There was a movie titled Lincoln about the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. The signing of the Emancipation Proclamation was included in the film Lincoln. The hanging of the Dakota 38 was not. In any case, you might be asking, why were 38 Dakota men hung?
We've been listening to Layli Long Soldier read an excerpt from her poem 38 in her collection, Whereas, from Grey Wolf Press. So can you talk to us about the circumstance a little bit, about the Sioux uprising, which you mentioned is the largest mass execution in U.S. history, but yet remains largely erased from memory from most non-Native Americans?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's more important to me is maybe just what you just said, is why it's erased.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it. You know, that's the point. That's the point of this poem. You know, why these stories are not retold. I mean, just the idea that I think that's what I was pointing towards, even in this very recent movie, well, somewhat recent movie, Lincoln. We're not going to include that.
Right.
Right. We're gonna make a story, make a movie, and tell the story of this wonderful president, and the struggles he had, and the good things he did. We're not going to recount anything that is troubling or uncomfortable for the viewers, for the listener. We don't want these stories, right? And I think that's also something we've been talking about. We talked a little bit this semester with my students, this idea of discomfort. And there's a Canadian poet named Shane Rhodes who wrote a book called X Poems, and he's a non-native. He's not from First Nations. He's a Canadian. He calls himself settler. But he's written this whole book sort of looking at the treaties between First Nations and the Canadian government. And clearly he's positioned himself, I think, on the side of or for the rights of First Nations people, you know, in view of these treaties. But in an interview, I thought this was really interesting, he was talking about this, his mistrust of this idea of discomfort. You know, he mistrusts that. And we were looking at that, and even the language that is applied to these kinds of conversations where we share these kinds of stories. This thing of discomfort or shame or guilt and whatever. Of course, we don't want to have these conversations. We don't want to hear these stories. We don't want to remember certain things. You know, we've moved on. Well, no, First Nations people haven't moved on. They remember them. Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of our family. It's part of our family history and so on. And so what if we begin changing the way that we understand those conversations? And I've talked about this before, so again, I hate ever repeating myself too much, but I still think it's really brilliant. This little video by Faith Spotted Eagle, and so there's this video, I think it's in under Lakota Essential Understandings. If you YouTube that, you'll find this. And she talks about this thing of the need for Native people to be able to give these stories a voice, to share them, you know, in a way that's part of our own healing and our own, you know, I think it's necessary to be completely present, right? But she talks about that, and she said, on the other hand, for the non-Native listener, this is not about shame or guilt, sharing these things. That's not healing. Shame and guilt, that's not healing to anybody. So it's not about that. But she said, it's really a freedom from denial and liberation. It's a so if we start thinking of that, a liberation, this becomes a liberation for all of us, you know. I think that really turns things on its head, right? And again, I'm sorry, I feel like I've talked several times in a few interviews about this idea, but I think it's central, especially to this piece, 38. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Yeah, you know? It was a great pleasure having you on Between the Covers today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
We're talking today to Layli Long Soldier, poet and visual artist, about her book, Whereas, from Grey Wolf Press. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 12 o'clock on the dot. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, December 20th, 2018. In national news, the latest news from the current presidential administration, documents have been released showing Trump signed a letter of intent to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, contradicting Rudy Giuliani's claim that there was no such letter. Mitch McConnell has introduced a stopgap spending bill to keep the government running, while Trump demanded that the government shut down and thousands of workers be furloughed in order to provide $5 billion for his border wall. In other national news, Trump has ordered a full and rapid withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria within 30 days. Bashar al-Assad is cheering the U.S. withdrawal, and the United States has been added to a list of the most dangerous countries for journalists for the first time ever. The U.S. Congress passed the $867 billion farm bill last week without including provisions that had been added by the Republican House to tighten work requirements for the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, often called food stamps. Now, the Trump administration is pushing to impose those same restrictions through changes in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA's new proposed rule is supposedly a trade-off.